Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. Today, we're introducing a new segment we're going to call The Merge. In air combat, it's when fighter aircraft engage in a dogfight and one side emerges victorious. And we think it's a pretty apt description for how the national security process works here in Washington, D.C. You've got multiple stakeholder positions and people are playing for keeps. Above all, the future of our nation's security is at stake in these debates. You've also got massive business deals and political equities on the line. Policy and budget decisions have seismic impacts felt over decades. So with that, we've designed this new segment to allow members of our Mitchell Institute team talk about what's hot in the defense world. Whether it's an article that may have gone viral, a new piece of technology, or happenings in Congress, we are going to dig into these topics and provide perspectives that are seldom covered, but they matter a lot. And you're going to be gaining insights through the eyes of the folks that have held key positions and spent decades in this arena. We are doing this once a month and may even have a few special episodes when something particularly interesting comes into play. If you have a topic you'd like covered, please send them our way. We'll also feature guests who have particular zones of expertise and operational credentials. With that, I'd like to introduce Mitchell Dean, Lieutenant General David Deptula, our Executive Director Doug Berkey, Mitchell's Director of Future Concepts and Capability Assessments, Mark Gunzinger, and Senior Fellow Heather Penny. Thank you all for being here today. To kick things off, I'd like to begin the conversation with the F-35. It's the bedrock on which America's fighter aircraft modernization program is built, but in recent weeks, it's seen a broad range of press from good to downright ugly. We're hearing rave reviews from pilots flying in combat, but it seems like the knives are out for it in Washington, D.C. I'm going to kick this off with Heather to start this one out. Heather, why is the F-35 such a big deal for the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the Navy, and our allies?
Thanks, Slick. As you've said, and the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General C.Q. Brown, has said, the F-35 is a linchpin for these forces. You see, stealth is simply the cost of entry to the modern battle space. Very few conflicts can be considered permissive anymore in terms of an air power perspective. It isn't just the high-end, pure conflict that will demand stealth. I mean, take a look at Syria. Park an S-400 there, and suddenly we had to commit F-22s and F-35s to that operation. So we should expect Russia and China to accelerate their export of these advanced air defenses because we know that, or they know that doing so pins down U.S. forces and poses dilemmas to U.S. commanders.
Hey, Heather, this is Deptula. Let me jump in here and just kind of reemphasize that point. People called for a no-fly zone in Syria. Well, how are you going to do a no-fly zone if you got S-400s in the area? This is something people don't think about. It's not necessarily that we need stealth for the high-end fights only, because that's in fact what we do need them for, as you say, as an entry-level requirement. But even in lesser kinds of contingencies that are populated by advanced double-digit SAMs, the only way they're going to be able to survive if an adversary starts shooting them, and you know, that's a whole nother conversation of why the Russians didn't in Syria, but you make an excellent point.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, sir. Whether old or new, these legacy platforms simply are not survivable. And we don't have the aircraft or the pilot production to backfill what those losses would be.
Sure. And I want to bring Gonzo in on the conversation too. And I know, Gonzo, you've been tracking the program. So what do you think is working well and where are the challenges?
Now, Slick, most defense analysts seem to focus on the program's challenges and not its successes. So I'm very happy you asked that. As Heather pointed out, the F-35 is the world's most advanced fifth generation stealth fighter. That's simply a fact. And second, I think it's useful to point out that the Biden administration's top national security priority is to build up America's alliance structures. So today, 13 nations and the United States are buying F-35s. Singapore has just recently joined a team, and sales to Emiratis are under review. Over 620 jets have been delivered as of today, and they've accumulated more than 360,000 flight hours, and 10 air forces have declared the F-35 IOC. So that jet
Hey, Gonzo, I hate to keep on jumping in on you guys, but I just want to reiterate for our audience. Probably the greatest strategic value of the F-35 is not its integrated avionics. It's not its stealth. It's not its ability to p- penetrate contested airspace, although all those things are extraordinarily valuable, is the fact that we have 12, now going on 13 and perhaps 14, friends, allies, and partners that are operating the same aircraft. That's huge. And it brings not just our air forces together, but our nations together.
General, you're exactly right. So the F-35 is, and it's going to continue to be, a means of strengthening our nation's alliances. And I think that point is lost in the ongoing debate over the program's cost. Speaking of which, you know, the F-35A cost is now below $78 million a copy. And that's the level which many skeptics just a few years ago said would never be possible. And that's also well below what the F-15EX is going to end up costing the Air Force. Sure, there's still concern over the cost to operate and sustain the force. Its flying hour cost for the F-35A is about $36,000 an hour. And that's still too high by anyone's measure. However, it's dropped by 40% since 2015. It targets to get it down to about $25,000 per hour by 2025 or shortly thereafter. But I'd like to point out, I'm sure, General, you're going to expand on this, that the metric that really counts is the cost to achieve effects in the battle space, not procurement and flying hour costs. And Congressman Adam Smith recently talked about the need for a fighter that is cost effective, by which he meant the latter. And the debate should really shift towards the cost effectiveness of the F-35 in future wars.
I want to hop in there with General Deptula, and you mentioned it, Gonzo, to the remarks that Congressman Adam Smith, and for those that don't know, he's the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, that he'd want to run away from the program. And he was pretty brutal in some recent remarks. So General Deptula, how did you view those comments?
Well, first, Slick, let me make it perfectly clear that I certainly do not buy into the headlines that have been made recently by folks like Congressman Adam Smith. But to be fair to him, let's take a look at his statements. Here are a couple of them that created those headlines that you mentioned. Quote, what does the F-35 give us? And is there a way to cut our losses? Is there a way to not keep spending that much money for such a low capability? Because as you know, the sustainment costs are brutal, unquote. Now there's a lot to unpack in that phrase alone. Let's start by answering his first question. What does the F-35 give us? And Heather and Gonzo gave us a couple of examples here. But what the F-35 gives us is the ability to penetrate contested enemy airspace and act as a sensor as well as a shooter. And as a key node that's going to be absolutely fundamental to the notion of joint all-domain command and control. The reason is because it will yield insights that will simply be unattainable by any other means except for one, and that's the very, very small force of F-22s that we have. So people need to understand the F-35's not really just a fighter. Because of the multitude of capabilities that it possesses, it can act as a bomber, an electronic combat aircraft, a reconnaissance aircraft, an early warning aircraft, a command and control aircraft. And all of these, as well as being a fighter aircraft, cloaked in stealth to go where no fourth generation or older aircraft design can go. So the F-35 gives us quite a lot, Congressman Smith, certainly much more than any other combat fighter that's producible within 10 years. Now, what about a second phrase? Quote, is there any way to not keep spending that much money for such a low capability? Because as you know, the sustainment costs are brutal, unquote. Well, based on the facts that I just related and that real F-35 pilots confirm, not budget analysts, F-35 capabilities are unmatchable by any adversary fighter in the world. That said, sustainment costs for the F-35 are high, but like any other new aircraft in the early stages of its incorporation into a combat force, those costs decrease over time. And that's going to be the case with the F-35. It's on track to sustainment costs comparable with fighters that have been in the force for over 30 years by 2025. Now, his next statement is one that's really revealing. Quote, "What I'm going to try to do is figure out how we can get a mix of fighter attack aircraft that's the most cost effective. And I am telling you right now, a big part of that is finding something that doesn't make us have to rely on the F-35 for the next 35 years, unquote. What? What, Congressman Smith? You want to do a cost effectiveness study, but you want to exclude the F-35 from consideration up front? That's not going to be a very objective study, Mr. Smith. Are you really interested in cost effectiveness or just cost? Achieving some arbitrary level of affordability that suits your definition without considering the consequences? If you don't consider all the elements that are required to accomplish the desired effects, you may come up with a combat aircraft that costs less on a unit cost comparison, but if it takes 10 or 20 of them to accomplish the same mission as one or two F-35s, then which one is most cost effective, Mr. Smith? Not to mention the lives involved and the degree of attrition that may be an order of magnitude higher than with stealth aircraft. These are all the elements that need to be included in any kind of cost effectiveness study. By the way, Mr. Smith, I've not done just a study. I've applied both stealth and non-stealth aircraft in combat in what the GAO called perhaps the most successful air campaign of the 20th century. As a principal planner of the Desert Storm air campaign, I can demonstrate to you with real data, not imagined war games by cost analysts, that the value of stealth is more than an order of magnitude greater than any non-stealth combat aircraft. And that makes them exceedingly more cost-effective than any possible alternative.
General Deptula, what would be like the one takeaway for this debate that the folks in DC need to really walk away with?
The takeaway is that one or two or a handful of F-35s can do the mission effect that it would take dozens and dozens of non-stealth aircraft to accomplish. So when you look at cost per effect, the F-35 is an enormous value and the most cost-effective weapon system that we are currently producing.
Well, I want to jump in with the point here.
You know, when you hear folks on the Hill and other skeptics bash the F-35 and compare it to other legacy aircraft, they're also not using a common base of assessment. You know, one of the most expensive things on a modern combat aircraft are all the sensors, the processing power, the data links, and all of that. If you look at how it's priced on something like an F-15, where when that taxis out for a combat mission, it's got things hanging off of its racks like crazy. All that's priced separately, and it's a huge amount of cost. On the F-35, it's all integrated, and it's all priced as a unit. And so if you really want to get to accurate comparisons here, you got to use apples to apples on this stuff, and they're not right now, and it's leading to some pretty false conclusions.
Yeah, if Mr. Smith is serious about eliminating wasteful, redundant, and unnecessary weapon systems in the U.S. military, he needs to look no further than the Army's grab on the deep strike mission area that's going to require billions of dollars to build one-way missiles and an air and space ISR architecture to guide them that already exists. So, you know, why did we stand up a Space Force if the Army is going to build their own? It's an absurd proposition, but the Chief of Staff of the Army is hawking this nonsense on the think tank circuit. You can read more about this in my op-ed on the topic that's coming out in Aviation Week on March 15th.
Well, and I'm going to pile in here too, because I think in any kind of cost assessment, it has to be a combat cost assessment. Coming to a cost assessment of forces and without contextualization of how they're going to deliver effects and be survivable, you're really just building a flying club at that point in time. So you have to ensure that when you're looking at what the appropriate force structure should look like, that it's done within the context of the threat. And we know that these legacy platforms are simply expensive coffins at this point in time.
All right, Doug, I want to transition over to you. Run us through some of the courses of action that the Air Force could take on this, and how would you rank the options?
Sounds like I appreciate it. You know, if you look at this, there are really three courses of action the Air Force has got. You know, first, you compress at the F-35, you address the known issues that are in play, and you turn up the capacity bias to reset the force fast. The next option is you can truncate the program, and you can seek to leapfrog to the next generation of technology, whether it's the next generation air dominance fighter or whatever. You can go to whatever your future goalpost is. Then finally, you can look at killing the program and stepping backwards by acquiring new build old designs like the F-15 or F-16. And you've already heard a lot of these opinions. But here's the deal. If you buy more F-15s and F-16s, you're acquiring something that's insanely expensive. It's not going to make it in the modern environment. And Syria should scare the heck out of us. You know, that wasn't fighting Russia or China directly. But if we give them the opportunity just to place high-end weapon systems in zones we're operating, that it might even be second, third tier threat environments initially, and then they plink that down, all of a sudden, we are absolutely screwed, and we need to really, really bolster against that. You know, you look at the training pipeline, aircraft production stuff. We don't have the production rates to make up for that sort of thing. And so it's an exceedingly dangerous position. You know, and on the new tech front, much of that hasn't been invented yet. And even things that are currently in play that you're going to need to build off of that are in the F-35 and other aircraft, if they're experiencing issues right now, that needs to get fixed now, because you have to have a solid foundation from which to build whatever is next. You can't just skip and hope it kind of works out. You have to address these things. It's like building a house. If you have a faulty foundation, it's not going to work. And so everything currently in play with that jet, you know, I get it. It's got to get fixed, but it can be fixed. And you don't have any future leading options without addressing some of those things. The other piece there is, if it's always about program next, all you're doing is dumping tons of money into R&D and then walking away from it just at the time you're trying to get the operational return when you're surging production. So it's hugely cost expensive for a little return. And, you know, it just leaves us with the reality here that whether you like it or not, the F-35 is the fastest, cheapest way of netting the goal of resetting the fleet. And so I think that's where they got to go. If there are problems, fix them. But we are where we are, and it's time to just double down on this.
Well, I do appreciate all the insights on the F-35. It is absolutely an extraordinarily important program for America. And moving along, in recent months, we've seen the services stampeding to reset the capabilities for a fight in the Pacific. And a lot of this is long overdue, given the inordinate focus on the counterinsurgency operations that we've been involved in for the last 20 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. But at the same time, we're seeing a pretty undisciplined process yield a lot of mission overlaps. With budgets tightening, we're not going to be able to afford wasteful redundancy. So it's causing us to want to do a scrub here. And one of the top areas, and General Deptula mentioned it, was that this regard for long-range strike. And the Air Force has long dominated in this realm with fighters and bombers. And now it's trying to be entered by other services, particularly the Army, and they're pressing ahead quite aggressively with long-range missiles. And as I understand it from budget documents, some of these are going to cost double-digit millions per shot. So it's a lot of money, even in Pentagon math. So I'm going to kick this over to Gonzo, and I'd like to hear what you have to say, because I know you've done a lot of work on this topic over the years. So help us understand the lanes of play with the various mission capabilities.
Thanks, Slick. I think it's important for our audience to know that standoff and penetrating strike capabilities really are complementary. Having both in the force increases the complexity of the challenge that the enemy must address. But the key for the future force is to establish the right balance between the two, the right mix of standoff and penetrating strike. So long-range standoff strikes can be accomplished by ground-based launchers, surface ships, attack submarines, and, of course, bombers. And depending on the range of their weapons, these platforms may be able to remain outside most of the coverage of an enemy's threat systems. And on the other hand, penetrating bombers, because of their stealth and other attributes, can survive inside contested areas and can approach targets much more closely and use short-range weapons on those targets, weapons that are smaller and less costly than most standoff weapons. So I'm going to offer three basic rules of thumb for weapons that might be helpful in this debate. First, the further a weapon must fly, the larger it is and the more it costs due to the need for it to carry more fuel to reach its target, guidance systems to direct its flight over long ranges, and so forth. Second, service launch long-range missiles are generally larger and more expensive than air launch weapons that carry similar size warheads, since those service launch weapons must have rocket boosters, which launch them to altitudes and into trajectory to allow them to reach their distant targets. And third, the faster a weapon flies, the more expensive it is, which is an important consideration for future hypersonic weapons. I'll just give you a couple quick examples. Now, stealth bombers can deliver multiple short-range 1,000-pound bombs per sortie, and they cost about, you know, $40,000 to $50,000 each per bomb. A standoff air-launched JASSM ER cruise missile, which also has a 1,000-pound warhead and a range that exceeds 500 nautical miles, costs about $1.2 million each. And in comparison, a future Army ground launch MRBM may cost $10 to $20 million each, depending on its booster and payload size. And if you add a requirement for hypersonic speeds, that weapon with a boost glide warhead could cost $30 to $40 million each. So that kind of helps fleshes out those general rules of thumb. And finally, back to my original point, if you overbalance the force towards long-range standoff strikes, you are going to reduce DoD's as a whole capacity to conduct long-range strikes, and that is really important when you consider future target sets against in a war with China or Russia that exceed 40, 50, 60,000 aim points in a typical air campaign.
Sure. Well, Doug, you and General Jeptula have written a lot about the notion of cost per effect. Is that a tool that could be useful for leaders making decisions in this area?
Yeah, so like I really appreciate you asking that one. You know, it's important to focus on this because, you know, in many ways, people refer back to historic roles and missions as, you know, hey, I've been doing this for decades, therefore let me keep doing it. And I'd say in the modern era, with the amount of technological change that we have going on, hey, if somebody else has a better way of doing it, it should be considered. However, there's a preface here. It's got to be done effectively in a way that advances the mission affordably. And so cost per effect is a really great tool on this because it really looks at the enterprise way of achieving the mission. And that's really the total life cycle of how you get the kill to make it, you know, blatantly obvious here. So if I was looking at cost per effect for a long range strike, I'd look at the cost of the respective weapons. You know, obviously a bomb coming off a stealth bomber that's penetrating is really in double digit thousands. In the modern era, that's pretty cheap. A standoff munition, whether it be a cruise missile or a long range strike missile being launched off the surface, you know, that can be millions per shot. And so I can drop a lot of JDAMs at double digit thousands before I'm going to hit the cost of one cruise missile, for example. The delivery vehicle matters a lot too. You know, an aircraft might appear to be expensive, but you can use that thing over and over and over every single day for decades. And that amortizes that cost on a mission basis tremendously. You know, if you look at a missile, especially the long range ones that could be, again, double digit millions, that is one and done. And so that is a huge amount of sunk investment for one use. And if you're looking at a theater air campaign that could have tens of thousands of aim points that you have to hit in a short period of time, that is massive cost. You know, another element that you want to look at here is logistics support. And do you really think transporting large volumes across the ocean is sustainable in high numbers? And so if you're looking at something the size of a SpaceX rocket, that's pretty intensive on your logistics supply chain. You know, it's a lot easier to ship some JDAMs across, and aircraft themselves self-deploy. You know, B-2s take off out of Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri and can reach anywhere in the world in a matter of hours. If you're going to deploy ground launch, you know, missile systems, it's an entirely different story, much more intensive. You got to look at the defensive required to protect the systems. And so do you have a stealth aircraft that can largely self-protect by virtues of its attributes, or do you need something that is going to have additive protective capability above it? Again, another bill that needs to be factored. You got to look at the targeting infrastructure. You know, for the Army, in the solution they're proposing, they're also talking about buying their own space-based satellites or aircraft to do the targeting information, to gather the coordinates of what they want to hit. That's insane duplication at huge cost. You know, Rand looked at this, and back in, I'd say around 2015 or so, and they actually came up with a pretty effective metric on this. And they basically said, if you have 20 days of an air campaign, stand-in stealthy aircraft are cheaper any day of the week than standoff missiles. And they were using cruise missiles that are very low cost relative to what these long-range ground-based missiles that could be flying thousands of miles would be. And so, and I'm not just saying 20 days each campaign, I'm saying 20 days total. Well, if you add up what we've done in recent years, whether it's Desert Storm, Bosnia, Kosovo, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, I mean, count how many days that is. It does not take long to exceed 20. So the bombers really have a huge advantage here that needs to be weighed. And so I'd say run the numbers, and leaders need to do that, but it needs to be done fast because the money is being consumed rapidly on duplicative systems. And I would argue one is far more efficient and effective.
I'd like to, Gonzo here, I'd like to foot stomp something you said, Doug. When I threw out my numbers, that was really a cost of an all up round. It didn't include the infrastructure, the logistics costs, and everything to deploy and employ those weapons in theater. So you made a great point. You have to take those logistics costs into account.
One of the things that kind of concerns me, and General Deptula, I want you to hop in on this one. So for years, we hear this term joint, and it's always hammered hard, especially if you are in the military. And this idea of Army doing long-range strikes seems like quite the opposite of a joint-type mission. As I understand it, the Army wants to buy its own ISR aircraft and their own satellite constellation to aim these missiles that we're talking about. So what is up with that, and how do you see this from a commander's perspective?
Well, bottom line, up front, Slick, what the Army is doing is pure encroachment of core Air Force roles and functions. And in this regard, I disagree with what Doug said about roles and missions being nonsense, because roles and missions are extraordinarily important. The Air Force, since its existence, has focused on the deep fight. The Army, by virtue of what it does, focuses on the close fight. And the fact of the matter is, from a cost-effectiveness perspective, building a new inventory of missiles as a solution for the Army's search for relevance in a peer conflict is both unnecessary and unaffordable. And it's way outside their core competencies. Now, the first combat use of the Army Tactical Missile System, also known as ATACMS in shorthand, was in 1991 during Desert Storm. In the following 30 years, 560 ATACMS have been fired. A wing of F-15Es could deliver the same effects in less than a week, and they could deliver that punch over and over again. Similarly, if you listen to Gonzo and what he said about the cost of the Army's new hypersonic missile potentially being upwards of $40 million a shot, and that's out there being reported and testified to, two shots could buy one F-35 that could achieve the same effects and go back again and again and again and again to multiply those effects repeatedly. Now, the real issue in play here kind of goes back to roles and missions, is the question of the Army building a set of weapons duplicative to capabilities that already exist in the Air Force and to a lesser degree in the Navy and the Marine Corps. Unfortunately, the weapons the Army are developing are prohibitively expensive, non-reusable, and they require extensive deployment logistics support. And just like Gonzo said, large missiles are not rapidly deployable and can't be used to meet unforeseen security challenges. So based on cost alone, they simply cannot be fielded in numbers large enough to be operationally significant in a major regional conflict. You know, Gonzo mentioned aim points. In Desert Storm, the nominal number of aim points was 40,000. But if you look at a scenario involving China or Russia or one of their surrogates, you're looking at over 100,000 aim points. The Army's never going to be able to afford that, nor be able to build that. Second, like you said, the Army wants to build their own command and control, as well as air and space-based intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance architecture. Well, that already duplicates what's already provided by the Air Force in its air and space operations centers. So the notion that the Army should build its own multi-domain sensor system, as they're calling it, to be able to identify and locate targets from air and space is the height of wasteful duplication and excessive redundancy. And it's another example of encroachment on Air Force roles and functions, and it flies in the face of supposed joint cooperation and interdependency.
Well, I think the debate will get really heated when the Army wants to buy their own ships to get these missiles to islands across the Pacific. And that's when the Navy can really hop in and get
angry. Well,
let
me jump in here. I mean, this is serious. I mean, if you really want to go in this direction, the most cost-effective way of doing it is to shift the long-range surface-to-surface missile area to the Air Force, along with the funds to produce them, because the Air Force is the one who, since its inception, has the knowledge and the perspective of employing weapons at theater, operational, and global ranges. The Army doesn't. The Army does mono-to-mono close combat. Only the Air Force has the perspective to understand and the system to be able to identify and employ weapons at range.
Well, Heather, I'd like to get you in on this conversation. I really wonder your perspective of where history would teach us about this debate, because clearly we've had roles and missions fights before. What do you think today's leaders can learn from the past as they sort this role thing out?
Well, you know, we have roles and missions fights when budgets get scarce and services have to justify themselves in their programs. Everyone's going to run to the mission that's bright and shiny. In this case, the Pacific Theater and Long Range Strike, to win relevance in the budget fight. There's only so much budget, and the Army's bid for Long Range Strike waters down what can be invested in real solutions for this mission. You know, the problem here is that Long Range Strike, as General Dubtula said, it doesn't play equally to each service's core strengths, and certainly not the Army. I know we're moving towards integrating the different domains, but that doesn't erase that the different domains have different attributes and characteristics, and we rely on each service to maximize and optimize their attributes for their domain. So the danger for the Army and the nation is that if they get what they want by going after long-range fires, it has a strong potential to erode the foundation of their combat power in their domain and their core missions. And that's going to mean that the joint force and our joint capabilities are going to be eroded as well. Look, the Army has a valued role in the Pacific, and it's one that gets back to their core established roles and missions, base defense. The problem is that OSD has allowed the Army to walk away from that joint responsibility. Take a look at what happened at Al Asad. No one asked why the Army wasn't protecting the base from Iranian ballistic missiles. That's akin to the Air Force walking away from close air support. The Army must be held to their joint responsibility for base defense.
Okay, we've saved one of the biggest topics for the end, national security space. At Mitchell, we've been quite emphatic that the Space Force must succeed. The capabilities they bring to the fight are crucial. But as I look at it, we still have a space enterprise where dozens of entities have control over various space assets. We have the Air Force and the Space Force, two separate services trying to survive off of less than 24% of the defense budget. We have a threat environment that's getting more and more dangerous every day. So if we want to start improving things in the 2021 legislative season, where do we start? General Dubtula, start us off. Where do we see the state of play and where do we need to go?
Well, just a bit of background for the audience. The Space Force was created to ensure that U.S. national interests are protected and defended in the warfighting domain of space. Yet, today, the new Space Force is underfunded, undermanned, and not in control of dozens of organizations that affect U.S. operations in space that should be under the purview of the Space Force. Real quick, regarding increased funding, the Space Force is only 2% of the entire DoD budget. It can't do its missions of organizing, training, and equipping forces to deter, defeat threats in space without more money. Regarding personnel, it's less than half the size of the Coast Guard. Yet space expertise is required to support the Space Force, the new Space Command, as well as individual services' unique space requirements. Now, regarding greater organizational authorities, if you recall, in proposing the U.S. Space Force in the first place, former Vice President Mike Pence said that our national security space program is spread across more than 60 departments and agencies, and that results in a glaring lack of leadership and accountability, and that undermines our combatant commanders and puts our warfighters at risk. Yet, while that seems like a reasonable rationale, none of those departments have yet to be integrated into the Space Force. So now's the time to set the Space Force up for success by taking the next steps to provide the human, budget, and organizational resources the new Space Force needs to build America's critical space capabilities.
Gonzo, you wrote about this thing called the pass-through within the Air Force budget. So how does that impact the struggle for adequate resources here?
Hey, Slick, great question. Pick up a copy of DoD's official budget report for fiscal year 21. It was great news to the Air Force. Air Force, which consists of the Department of the Air Force with the Air Force and the Space Force, two services, received the highest share of DoD's defense budget compared to the other services, 29.4%. Fantastic. Until you peel the cover off what's really going on. The fact of the matter is, there's a big chunk of funding inside that budget. It's called pass-through funding that goes to national intelligence classified programs over which the Air Force has little or no control. So that 29.4% for the Air Force and Space Force shrinks to about 24%. And that's the lowest amount across the services. For the Air Force alone, it shrinks to 21%, because remember, out of that 24%, you're trying to fund two services. A service was stood up, the U.S. Space Force, without any increase to the Department of the Air Force's budget whatsoever. So you're now funding two services off the lowest share of the defense budget across the service departments. And that goes a long way toward explaining why the Air Force over the last 30 years hasn't been able to modernize its forces and has had to retire current force structure like 17 B1s, which they just did, to fund other programs, because that's the same pattern that's existed since the end of the Cold War.
Hey, Gonzo, those are awesome points. And I want to jump on what you're saying here. Let me just make this ultra simplistic from 500,000 feet, but the point holds. The Army is getting just under 30% of the defense budget. That is one service. You've got two services, the Air Force and the Space Force, down around 20%. Do the math here. And you're right. It's why you've got the oldest, smallest Air Force. And it's why you have a Space Force that's been living off a starvation diet, trying to satisfy everybody's joint requirements. This is not sustainable. You cannot fund two services and get the capacity and capabilities you want out of them for 20% of the defense budget. That's insane. We need a rebalance.
Heather, you're Mitchell's lead with concepts relating to things like combat cloud, the Joint All Domain Command and Control System, or JADC2. Another one is the Advanced Battle Management System, or ABMS, and Mosaic Warfare. And all of these things are operating concepts that are defining the future of combat. So how does space tie into all of them? And what does it say about the criticalities of these reforms?
Space is the backbone of all current and future combat operations. There's really not a mission that the Joint Force does that doesn't somehow rely on space. So whether mission planning, communications, space-based sensing, missile launch warning, and so many other and often classified capabilities, space is crucial. JADC2, ABMS, Mosaic Warfare, anything we do in the future will only rely even more on space than we already do. So the reforms that Gonzo and General Deptula have talked about whether budget reform or continuing to consolidate space capabilities under the Space Force is essential. Right now, with those space capabilities spread across the DoD, this is the ultimate in penny packeting. And we all know from experience how dividing up forces like that depletes combat power. We won't be able to achieve a fully integrated JADC2, ABMS, or Mosaic warfare if space is not brought together as a coherent whole under the Space Force.
Well, Doug, you spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill. How do you see the politics on this?
Yes, first off, I think the conversation needs to move past just being, space advocacy for the sake of being independent. We've done that. And it's now to how do you drive this thing for the long haul? And so that's a totally different set of questions that's focusing on things like the policy decisions, the budget issues, strategy, doctrine, and much of what we've already heard here in the conversation. And so it doesn't involve focusing on things like new uniforms, rank structures, and all that. It's not going to keep China and Russia up at night. We need to look at what gets as much space operational capability as far forward as possible. And so, Gonza just talked about it. There's way too little budget here. You've got about 20% of the defense budget for the Air Force and the Space Force. That's not survivable. We need to look at resource reallocation to space. And it's not just going to come out of the Department of Air Force budget. Everybody relies on space and it needs to be funded accordingly. And then we got to streamline the bureaucracy. General Deptula nailed this. If you've got over 60 entities focused on space, that is a ton of overhead. And it's not focused on mission. It's focused on just running headquarters and things. And we create the Space Force, capitalize upon it, centralize it there, and try to turn the bureaucratic money into operational money. And then, I think this is a situation where the Space Force had a lot of energy with the stand-up, and that's fantastic. But we now need to understand that the budgets are going to get tight. So we have got to fix these things now. The energy to continue messing with this is going to run short. And so it's something that we need to really look at near-term fixes and make the hard calls now. We cannot risk the operational capabilities long-term.
Yeah, Doug, I couldn't agree more. And, for the folks out there in the business world would understand, we had the capability of doing a tremendous mergers and acquisitions type of thing from a leadership standpoint, cut a lot of overhead and put a lot of focused leadership on all these various agencies that you mentioned out there. So that just makes sense on how we need to move forward. And while I do agree that Guardians need a unique uniform for themselves, that can't be the only thing that comes out of standing up the Space Force. So with that, for this panel, that's all the time we have for today. And I appreciate you sharing your thoughts on these topics. And one thing is for certain, that 2021 is going to involve some key decisions that will shape the defense force for a long time. With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to our guests for joining in today's discussion. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.